Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome, Amy Brown from CCLA to FUBAR Radio and Just Not Good Enough. Very good to see you here. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I did rather sideswipe you, didn't I, at a presentation that you were doing at a CCLA seminar where you were talking about all sorts of things that your organisation does for not just mental health, but the social goods that can come out of financial investment.
Right.
And I apologise for doing that because I had to take advantage of that moment, unfortunately. But anyway, you're here. Now, CCLA, I'll just run through a little bit of an intro so that people know the background, a little bit of it. CCLA is an investment house, as I understand it, for, let me get this right, church, charity and local authorities.
Yes, correct.
Right, okay. And I have to say, I was very impressed by your presentation, actually.
Thank you.
Particularly, we're going to come on to it later, but the toolkit, I thought that was just absolutely brilliant. And we'll also come to the way of how you ended that little presentation as well. We've got some things to talk about. So let's start with your career. Okay. So where are we now? So you work with a heavy focus on the social utility of finance as a public good. What does that mean?
Oh, well, where do we start? So I think finance has a really bad rep, doesn't it? Even now. Financial services particularly. But I really think that people are missing a trick when it comes to the good that financial services can do, as well as the damage that it can create. And really for shareholders, you know, companies or individuals that buy shares in businesses, there is such an amazing opportunity to use our voice as investors to drive changes at the businesses that we're investing in, to persuade or cajole or incentivize businesses to improve the way that they look after their own employees, to improve their labor standards, to improve their environmental impact. There is so much potential for investors to be a force for good in the world rather than just greedy money makers. And so that's what we try to do.
Do you think it's getting better? I mean, that's absolutely right what you've just said. Yeah, it could be a fantastic force for good. Yeah. But we're stuck with capitalism, aren't we?
We are stuck with capitalism. And we have a particular problem in the States at the moment with the culture wars and the huge so-called ESG backlash.
Yeah. They're more capitalist than we are.
Yes.
And you've got Trump coming in, who is probably the arch enemy of the do-gooders. No, that doesn't sound right. The do-gooders, does it? But it's going in the wrong direction, isn't it?
It is going in the wrong direction. But I think it's very important to stand firm. And also, you know, doing good, as you say, do-gooders don't necessarily cost businesses money. Often if you improve your labor standards, if you make your workplace a better place to in which to work, if you help your employees to thrive, that can actually only logically be supportive of the long-term and sustainable success of a business.
But it's a very well-documented business case, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of looking after your people, creating the right environment, making them feel psychologically safe. And, you know, the returns, the financial returns because of that are... So why aren't we all doing it?
I don't know.
Well, no, it's a big question.
It's a big question,
isn't it, that? Yeah. Anyway, we're going to come back to all of that, I'm sure. So you went to James Allen Girls School.
Yeah.
3 A-levels. You then went to York University, got a first in history. Well done. Very good.
Thanks.
I did history A-level and failed it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, but I have much more of an interest in history now than almost anything else, actually.
What were you doing instead?
This is an interview about you, not me, for God's sake. You were president of the Fusion event, a charity.
Oh, my gosh, nobody's ever asked me about this.
I'm not going to ask you, I'm just merely pointing it out. So, and you were a model for 10 years as well. And I'm going to come back to that because I think the culture in modelling is a very interesting one, mm-hmm. particularly if you're in the very senior positions, as in celebrity type positions. So what the hell did you do to going into financial services for after that?
I got a bit old, to be honest.
What do you mean old?
Like by sort of, you know, by the time you... Well, I started at 16 when I got my first agent.
Yeah.
And then did a bit through the during my A-levels and then full-time during my gap year when I travelled a lot. And then, well, I wanted to use my brain. And I'm afraid to say, when you are... I read a LinkedIn post the other day that made me so angry when someone was saying, models, sports people, they're all stupid, so why should we listen to them? And I almost replied in the heat of the moment with some expletives. But it's not to say people in fashion are definitely not stupid. No. But often you get caught up in conversations around, you know, if you're having your hair and makeup done for a couple of hours, it might be. So the conversation typically started with, so what star sign are you then? And I thought, God, not another star sign conversation. I can't cope. And so I really wanted to use my brain. I wanted to get into that state where, you know, where your brain works so hard that it starts to burn and it feels a little bit like a muscle.
Well, it is.
And I love that. I love that feeling. Yeah. And I wasn't really getting that at all. And I felt a little bit old. And also, you know, modelling is the sort of career, if you can call it that, where a new person can come in from day one and shoot right to the top.
Yes,
there's no other
true.
Career like that.
Yeah.
Where,
yeah.
you know, where you step up and
but
you
why,
get better.
But why that? I can understand why you did that. That's because I can imagine that's quite fulfilling in a way. But history to financial services, I don't quite get that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't know what I wanted to do. After uni.
Do you now?
Oh yes.
Do you?
Yes.
Because I've never known what I wanted to do.
I've found my calling, I think.
Have you?
Yes.
In financial services,
yes.
In this sector.
In sustainability in financial services.
Because there's a lot of charity that goes through your career, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, very quickly back on history,
yes, no,
though.
Keep
because
going,
I know
keep going.
Why I think history is very relevant because at school when you're learning about history, you have to learn facts and dates and you have to blurt them back out again when you're doing your exams.
Mm-hmm.
At uni, you're not really learning about facts. I don't think I learned any facts about any historical figures in uni, but what I learned to do was to use evidence to build an argument with and then to present that argument in a very persuasive way.
Yeah.
Based on evidence.
Yeah.
You know, and so we were always taught argument, evidence, argument supported by evidence, argument, evidence. And in this job that I'm doing now, when I'm speaking to businesses and trying to get businesses to change, is exactly the same thing. You're supporting, you're creating an argument why this business should do a certain thing. You're supporting it with evidence and presenting it in a very persuasive way.
Yeah, yeah.
So those, I suppose, are the transferable skills, if you like.
No, I hadn't thought of it like that before, actually. And I used to work with a guy who was a financial analyst, and I found out subsequently that he was an art degree. He had an art degree. And I thought, oh my God, you know, how? But it's not about the subject matter. It's about how you think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's making you think for yourself and think about things in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what secondary education is all about, isn't
yeah.
it? Or tertiary education, I suppose it is. And there's charity coming through all of that as well,
yes.
isn't there?
Yes.
So do you have you got a social conscience, if that's the right way of saying it?
Well, I hope so. I hope some kind of conscience, at least. I've been brought up in a very traditional English family with very traditional English values, probably, you know, stemming from the Church of England, I suppose. But, well, my dissertation at uni was on charitable giving in the medieval church. Or medieval
oh,
England.
Oh, really?
And actually the whole thing was very cynical. It was all about charitable giving in the Middle Ages was all about giving money and then having your face or name put on a stained glass window in a church. It was all,
yes.
it was all about
alternative
personal
motives.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the same is true today, of course.
It's no, there's a certain, there's a, it's being altruistic is a positive.
Yeah.
But as long as you do it for the right motives, exactly. isn't it? And it's about you do it because you want to help, not because you want to get an award or do something like that.
But to be very clear, you know, these companies that I've worked for are profit-making organisations.
Yes, I haven't,
they're not profit. They're not non-profit organisations. But what they do is, I've been working for charity teams where we manage the money, the endowment funds of charities in the UK.
Yeah, because that does cause a difficulty, doesn't it? Because you are a profit-making organisation, yeah. and your investors are hopefully profit-making people as well. Some of which are organisations, I guess.
Yeah.
And you've got the charitable side. You're dealing with charity money. I mean, how do you sort of square that?
Well, our investors are the charities. So a lot of charities have millions of pounds as investments, in investments, and they entrust those investments to us, and then we buy shares in companies on their behalf.
But does that cause? I wouldn't say it causes a contradiction.
In the public eye, it can be tricky because not everybody. Realizes. Okay, so we go back to what the charity trustees, their ultimate aim, so that what they are there to do is to balance the interests of today's beneficiaries with the beneficiaries of the future. So if you're giving money to charity today, that money doesn't necessarily all go to that charitable good on that day. Often, and we're thinking, for example, something like the Poppy Appeal in the Royal British Legion, that money will go into an endowment, like a pot of money that gets invested.
Yeah.
And so that money can continue to be invested generation after generation, and then the income that investment produces is spent on the company's day-to-day charitable activities.
Yeah.
And so if you're lucky enough to have an endowment as a charity, then you are safeguarding or balancing the interests of today's beneficiaries with those of the future.
In the main, do charities have a more adventurous attitude to risk, or do they say, no, hold on, we're a charity, we need to be...
It's a really interesting question. Some, in theory, because these charities typically have very, very, very long investment time horizons, they want to be in existence generations into the future.
In perpetuity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They should, in theory, have a very high tolerance to risk.
Yes.
They should be very happy for the value of their portfolio to go up and down, as long as, if they need the income, as long as that income is steadily coming through. Some charities, I'm not going to name the one I'm thinking of, but some charities, particularly those that are sometimes in the public eye a lot and subject to quite a lot of criticism, because they are very, aware that they're dealing with public money, they can be very nervous about taking on significant risk in their investment portfolio.
Yeah.
So they'll typically weight higher in bonds or cash.
Yeah. So they're moving down the scale of risk,
aren't
they? It's interesting because I'm a trustee of two charities, actually. Glebe Common, which is near where I live, and a charity called National Star, which looks after disabled kiddies. And we have a very, very, very long-term view, but our risk profile is medium.
Yes.
And when it came round to doing the... So this is slightly off track here, but when I came round to doing the questionnaire about what risk, I put low. Because it's a charity, I feel it should be low. But actually, that's wrong, isn't it? It should actually be relatively high risk, provided you don't need the capital.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So... let's talk a little bit about your presentation, because I just thought it was fantastic. And it was centred on the social utility as a public good, wasn't it?
Yes.
And it's the fact that you can use money to go and do good beyond just getting a return for your investors.
Yes.
And in today's world, that is just so, so, so important. And you monitor the large companies, and I've seen the list of them. There's about, I don't know, a couple of hundred or something that you monitor, not all of which engage, which is interesting in itself. You rank them, you publish the data, and some of them get better.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that you're asking them to do differently in order for them to get better, particularly in how they look after their people?
Yes, okay. So one of the initiatives that we're working on is around improving the mental health of the people of organisations. So, and the reason for this, because often mental health can be seen as a slightly odd topic for an investor to be looking at, but the reason is that actually there's a very compelling financial case for action. So businesses in the UK are losing to mental ill health around about, in dollar terms, $1,900 per employee every year.
And that's per all employees, not just those that have a mental health issue.
Exactly, all employees. So if you add up the cost and you divide it by all of the employees in the UK in the private sector, $1,900.
That's frightening.
That's a lot.
That's more than a lot of people earn in a year in other parts of the world, isn't it?
Yeah. And that is from a combination of three things, mainly. One is people being at work but not well, and so not, you know, being as productive as they could be. It could be people being off sick. And, you know, when you're off sick for mental health reasons, you're often off sick for several weeks, if not more.
Yeah. Because you wait, don't you? So, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you wait until the last minute.
Well, that's part of the problem.
And then people, you go, and that's it, you're gone for weeks.
People
as opposed
tend to try to hide it in the workplace setting because often they believe that they're going to be reprimanded or, you know, not
promoted. But history says that, doesn't it? Not history, but the record says that you are.
Yes.
I think Deloitte did something and they said that 70% of people who confessed, that's not the right word either, but came out about the fact that they've got a mental health issue, either had their responsibilities reduced, so demoted or sideways, or sacked.
Yeah.
And is it any wonder that people
are
frightened?
I think it's slowly, slowly changing. But to your point, if these people sought help sooner, before it reached crisis point, then everyone stands to gain.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, there's a huge onus on the companies then to create an environment within which people are comfortable sharing their own experiences. And we can go on to, maybe we're going to go on to this later, but the role of the chief executive is very, very important as well.
Yeah, so at this point, or not at this point, generally at the end, I ask people what their plastic bag moment is, right? So if you remember, I know you're looking blank, which is not surprising, everybody does. Right. These sorts of changes need a spark. So the civil rights with Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and all that sort of stuff in the US. There's just that defining moment where everything changes direction. In the UK, for plastic bags, the government said, right, 10p on every bag, boom, 90% gone overnight.
Yeah.
And I just sort of feel that we're in business. We're at that moment almost now. It's sort of creeping up on us, but there's a barrier, and the barrier, and I always ask people, say, well, what do you think your plastic bag moment is for mental health in business? So what would be the defining moment? And what you've just said is exactly what my plastic bag moment is. Mm-hmm. It's getting a chief executive to come out.
Yeah.
But I only know of two, and they weren't in their job when they did it.
Oh, interesting. Which of those two?
It was Antonio...
Lloyds?
Yes, yeah. Lloyd's guy and head of Virgin Money.
Okay.
Which was, that was a while ago. Although interesting, I had the finance director of Heathrow here and he came out and he was still employed and now he does great work. Still is finance director at Heathrow, but he's much more focused on helping people, making it safer environment, a better working environment.
Yeah.
So, but what is it you think that prevents CEOs exposing their vulnerabilities in public?
Well, first of all, I don't think all CEOs will have a vulnerability necessarily.
True.
And that shouldn't be seen as a weakness.
I've got to say a weakness. They must have weaknesses.
Yes, of course. Yes. But in, you know.
Yeah, vulnerability is an interesting word.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, we shouldn't assume that if a leader hasn't had a mental ill health, you know, hasn't gone through a period of mental ill health, then they're not a good leader. So,
no.
So not every chief executive is going to have a story to tell.
But one in four in the country has a mental health issue at some point.
Yeah.
So the chances are, if you look at the FTSE 100 and you've got 12 directors each, there's 1,200 people there. I cannot believe that there aren't some in there with mental health issues.
But beyond a sort of own story of a chief executive, if a leader is silent on this topic, and people are going to assume that they also should be silent on this topic.
Yes.
If a chief executive comes out and says, very simply, mental health is a business concern. It's a business risk. We are incredibly supportive of our people, and we want to do everything that we can to create an environment within which people can thrive. If you come out and say that publicly, and you spread that out throughout your channels internally, you repeat that message again and again, then that is really key to unlocking that safe, psychologically safe environment.
Yes.
Interestingly, so you mentioned the ranking. So we've launched this this thing that, called the CCLA Corporate Mental Health Benchmark.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, it assesses and ranks companies based on their mental health disclosures. So what they say they do about supporting them, the mental health of their employees. Interestingly, if you were last year, we did some analysis where we, and one of the criteria of, there are 27 questions in total, one of them is, does your company have a statement from your chief executive setting out its approach to mental health? Now, if we split the companies into two groups, one group A is companies that have a chief executive statement, group B is companies that don't, and then you strip out the points for having had that statement in the first place from group A, then group A, even once the points are removed, scores 75% higher across the rest of the criteria. Wow. Than group B. Now, this may not necessarily, it doesn't prove causation.
No.
But it's a really
even if it's
point.
50% causation, yeah. It's still pretty good, isn't it?
And it sort of shows that once that is, in theory, once that tone is set from the top, then everything else beneath it falls into place more easily.
Can I make a distinction though between somebody saying, to be cynical about it, corporate bollocks, versus I have an issue with XYZ? That there is a difference there, because one is about seem to be doing what, which is what we've just spoken about, seem to be doing the right thing, whatever that means. And the other one is saying, look, I that's what I believe, and actually I'm in that position myself. Mm. Isn't that stronger and more powerful?
So you mean the employee, the
chief
leader.
Exec.
And a lot of leaders do now, share their own stories. There's absolutely value in that. And actually, when we first did the assessment, I'm just going to check because I need to get this right. But when we first started the assessment, we did it the first time, Lloyd's was right up there at the top.
That doesn't surprise me.
But then after he left, it slipped down a little bit.
Wow.
I mean, it's still one of the leading companies, but it's not as good as.
Yeah, so it shows you that it is, the CEO is the most influential and the most powerful in making these issues better in their organisation.
Can be, yes.
Okay.
And interestingly, when I spoke to the team there, they said, yes, there has been a little bit of a, the emphasis has slightly changed internally. For example, the charity that they're supporting as a firm is no longer a mental health charity. So I suppose the dialogue inside the company is not so fully focused on mental health anymore. And of course that then means that there's less day-to-day conversation about mental health, and then of course people are probably less likely to want to talk about their own experiences, and then it sort of starts to wind back a little bit all the progress that having been made.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, we were talking earlier about off air actually before we came on about Michael Mosley, mm-hmm. and his Just One Thing, and making the little changes that you can make a part of your everyday life. That's what needs to happen in business, isn't it? So that you don't rely on a single individual at the top. And if he's there, great. And if he's not there, sorry, he could be a she. If he's not there, then it all falls away. It's got to be part of the inculcated, embedded culture of that organisation, isn't it?
And you know what? Actually, a lot of this moves. A lot of this is actually about workplace design as well. So yes, you've got to have
physical.
Well, just sort of all round. What is your working life like? So, some of the indicators in this benchmark are about the fundamental principles of good work, or what Americans would call decent work, and whether the company has a formal position on each of these areas, and whether they explicitly make the link to mental health. So, for example, really basic, fair pay and financial well-being.
Like, oh, it's a minefield.
Just, you know, no number of yoga sessions and like well-being packs and like, you know, free fruit is going to make up for the fact that you're not feeling like you're being paid fairly for the work that you're doing.
Yeah.
So pay might not be seen as a mental health issue, but it absolutely is.
Well, financial difficulties is totally, because, you know, how the hell am I going to feed my family, pay for my mortgage, etc.
Exactly. So there's a sort of big overlap with sort of living wage and those types of topics on the one hand. But then also, if you look at the culture of a business, so anti-bullying and non-harassment, for example, if you are, I mean, it's so obvious, isn't it? If you're being bullied at work,
you're not going to be happy.
You're not going to be happy, and you're not going to be productive, and you're probably going to be taking days off. And that's not good for the business either. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you are from, you know, a member of a so-called minority and you're not being included, and you don't feel as though you are being fully integrated into the team or into the business, again, you're not going to be a happy or productive employee of that firm.
Interesting, when I was at Guinness, I was there for 4 years. From day one, I didn't feel included.
Really?
Yeah, from day one. It was the first thing that somebody said to me, about 5 or 6 words, and there was a tone in the voice that said, what the hell are you doing here?
Wow.
From that moment on, for 4 years, I was unhappy.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but that's because I have a particularly mental health condition where I get myself into, it drops down into a low state and I find it really difficult to get out of. Mm. But that made me so unproductive, which is why I ended up being asked to leave at the end of it, because I wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
You know, hence the title of this show, just not good enough. So one of the things that I am particularly interested in is boardroom behaviour. And you touched on behaviour just then, because when Superdry was a entrepreneurial family type business. Mm-hmm. And it's still difficult to work there because of the style of the various entrepreneurs that there were in the organisation. But it was so relaxed and, you know, almost, dare I say, friendly. Mm-hmm. And then we listed and we ended up with me and the CEO on the board with 6 to 8 non-execs who broadly were white, old, middle-aged men who'd made their career out of the behaviours of the past, the accepted behaviours of the past, which is bullying, aggression, leaping on other people, blaming other people, making themselves look good, self-mythologising, you name it. And that behaviour came out in the boardroom, but it's behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Right? So nobody sees it, nobody calls it out. And that then, which is what we were saying earlier, that then goes down the organisation. How do you address the behaviour at board level? And that's a tough question for somebody. And I don't know what your experience is of senior management meetings about the behaviour in that.
As an employee, you're one step removed from the behaviour of the boardroom.
You are.
I think always expect that they're perfectly well behaved.
No, they're not. They're not. They're bloody horrendous. Wow. Honestly, sometimes they are horrendous.
Yeah.
I'll just say this quickly, but I had a bad experience at one board meeting where this bloke, he just would not let go. And he was just boom, boom, boom. And I just, I gave up. And then I was silent for the rest of the meeting. I spoke to the chairman, who then spoke to him, this person. And they were perfectly okay the next meeting, right? And I thought, that's interesting.
What, civil?
Yeah.
Civil and polite.
Yes, treating me with respect. Yeah. The meeting after that, absolutely back to type.
Oh, no.
And not another word was said about it. Oh. And we're saying, you know, the behaviour at the top dictates what happens underneath. So people see that. And they'll come out and see me looking like shit and other members of the people who happen to be in there looking okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And suddenly think, I wonder what's happened to Chaz.
Mm.
And I'd tell them, I'd say, because he's being an arse, you know, that particular person there. And then, do I then hand it down to them? I tried not to, but it's quite difficult sometimes because you're frustrated and you're angry and you're under pressure and all that sort of stuff. And it does happen. Yeah. So how do we get the boards to change? And you must meet a lot of board members in your job.
No, I don't meet very many board members.
You're not?
No. But But often it's, well, actually, I'm going to explain what we did last week. So because it is quite fun, actually. So when we published the UK benchmark, when was it? In June.
Uh-huh.
So this was the third iteration of the UK mental health benchmark that ranks now 101 UK listed companies. So we published the benchmark, and alongside that, we have built an investor coalition. So we have a group of, I think it's 56 institutional investors who have
signed up. 7 trillion under investment.
Seven percent
of the world GDP.
Pounds, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Fantastic.
Yeah, £7 trillion supporting this. So what we did is we said, right, okay, so how are we going to get these companies to listen? Because up until now, we'd been emailing companies. We'd been emailing our contacts at the companies. Some of them are brilliant. Some of them, it will be the sort of generic investor relations inbox. Some of the companies, the ones who have engaged with it more, have, you know, it'll be the well-being lead or the chief medical officer, or sometimes this mental health falls under
chief medical officer's interesting.
HR banner.
Why chief medical officer?
Sometimes that's where well-being, health and well-being sits into the medical space.
Isn't it a line manager's role?
This is the person that sets the policy and makes sure on the day to day sort of this is the sort of day to day management group in the governance structure, if you like. But you know, a lot of these people are fairly junior and really doing their best to be heard. And so, you know, part of the point of this benchmark is to empower those people to, and I want them to use it as an ammunition when they're trying to build support for mental health in their business, when they're trying to, you know, maybe get more money so that they can spend on looking after their people, on creating the right support systems. And so we thought, right, okay, so some of these emails that we're sending to companies obviously aren't really being read, because not all of the, you know, 70 of the 101
is passive, isn't it? Emails are passive.
Really passive. And you can pretend that you never received them, and they often go into junk folders. And et cetera, et cetera. And some of them, you know, some of the people we've been speaking to have said, this is great, but I'm really struggling to get it, you know, further up the management agenda. So what we did is we thought, okay, well, what can we do? So we wrote a letter addressed to the chief executive directly of every single one of the 100 companies in the benchmark. Takes fucking ages. It sounds so simple.
Did you do it by pen?
But you've got to, luckily
not by pen.
No, I suppose
you have to make them relevant, don't you?
But you've got to bespoke each one.
Yeah.
And also, which isn't, you know, it's not that hard, but it's 101 letters. You've got to bespoke each one with bespoke recommendations. So we'd assessed every company, very, very detailed assessment. And so we brought out the sort of 4 or 5 main recommendations for each business and put them in bullet points. And then put at the top of the letter the people that we were also emailing this to, so the people that we've been contacting, whether it's the investor relations, chief medical officer. And then at the end, for the people that I really liked and people who'd been really cooperative, I said in this letter to the chief executive, with particular thanks to XYZ person for their amazing cooperation. And I thought, okay, because that's also a little bit of an incentive for that person to continue engaging with us, because the chief executive is going to have their name in front of them.
Yeah.
And I think
hopefully they will actually go and speak to them and say, oh, God, this letter is really
And you'll be like, well done.
Yeah.
But that letter then didn't just go by email. We actually sent them by post in an envelope with paper. And I honestly, I was stuffing envelopes. 3 or 4 people took pity on me in the office and was helping me with these envelopes. But we put a copy of this really beautifully designed benchmark report.
I know, I've read
report,
that, or some of it, yeah.
Which, if you're listening, you won't be able to see it, but it's a beautiful A4
no, they will.
Publication.
They will see it if you hold it up to the camera.
Oh, no, and my face.
No, it's that way.
Oh.
There.
Where?
There. So, yeah, got it.
There?
Got it, yeah.
Along with the letter that we'd printed, we also there's a ranking in there that has a list of companies. It's very obvious where your company is ranked. But we took the extra step of highlighting in a pink highlighter where the company is ranked that we were writing to. So for example, shouldn't really pick out names, but for example,
a company like
Howden Joinery.
Okay. Oh, right.
Didn't engage with the benchmark. I haven't responded to any of our attempts to get in touch. And the chief executive received a letter that had Howden Joinery highlighted in pink in the bottom performance tier of this benchmark. So, and a lot of people have got back in touch with us saying, my chief executive passed this letter to me and now we'd like to take the opportunity to talk to you about it.
Yeah, you see, it's that, but you're going in at the very top, aren't you? Right. And it's what we were saying about the chief executive coming out and saying something, you know. When I was looking for jobs, I always, it was years ago, so you know, no internet nonsense. I always used to write to the chief executive directly.
Yes.
You know, with a bespoke letter like you did, signed, you know. And I've probably got two or three jobs later in my career because of it.
Really?
Yeah, because...
It's got to be brave, haven't you?
Really? I don't think it's bravery. I think it's just, it's sort of obvious. Yeah. Because what they're going to do is they're not going to read it, but they will pass it to their... secretary, and their secretary will say, send it to, well, the secretary will send it to whoever.
Yeah.
And if they don't do it, they've got the chief executive on their back.
Yes, very clever.
You know, and it worked. And I only did sort of 20 letters each time. Mm-hmm. And I generally got a response from, I don't know, 25% of them. Mm. So when you get into an organisation, do you actually go and see them as well?
What, physically?
Yeah.
Not often. Sometimes.
Because you see, isn't that part of the investment process, if you like? Like an investment analyst or a...
Weirdly, very little of this happens in person anymore. So, I mean, sometimes, like the other day, I had four calls with four different companies in a day.
But you're doing it on Teams?
On this topic. Yeah, in Teams.
Ah, okay.
Sorry, so, is that what you're talking about?
No, I was basically saying you're making contact with them.
Oh, yes.
You're not just sending them data and then sending an email.
I have hundreds of conversations with these companies. And I feel so sorry for the person who sits next to me because I literally have the same conversation again and again and again, or
a
variation.
A bit like today, actually. Yeah.
Oh, no. Nothing like this before. One company, interestingly, and it was our great contact, a great friend at BT, took this benchmark early on to the board and nominated or targeted a non-executive director and said, I really need you to champion mental health, and this is the reason why. And he handed him the benchmark. And now BT are in tier one.
Yeah, you see, that's how it works. Mm. That's how you do it.
But it takes a sort of visionary individual who is persuasive and willing to.
But why wouldn't they be when the return on their investment just for doing this is
£5.30 on average?
It is indeed. Yes, yes, I know that. I thought it was £5 actually, but I'm going to now use the £5.30. But if you then think about all of that good work that's going on. In society at the moment, there are, and this comes out in your, I think in your presentation, actually, mm-hmm. maybe it wasn't you, it was your colleague, mm-hmm. but the trends that are happening in society at the moment are only going to make this worse. So what people are doing now probably won't be enough in 10 years' time. Things like, and I look at, you know, extreme weather, livelihood crisis, climate action, social cohesion, infectious diseases, you know, the list, mental health is the next one. The list goes on and on and on, and it's just going to get worse, isn't it?
So these, I think those risks that you listed are what we describe as systemic risks. So they are, you know, looking at this from an investment perspective, they are risks that apply to the system as opposed to being company specific. So as an investor, you can't diversify away from them. You can't avoid these risks. They are inherent to the way that the
climate change, you can do something about, but it's a tiny bit of what actually is needed.
But eventually,
but you have to do it.
It's going to come back and harm the value of all investments in the future.
Yes, it will.
So when it comes, so for example, our approach in the mental health space is rather than trying to engage with companies individually. So for example, we might have a portfolio with 100 investments in it, rather than trying to pick them off one by one and get them to improve. We are literally setting out to change the system, to change the expected way in which or the accepted way in which business is done when it comes to mental health. And the theory of change really is that a rising tide lifts all boats. And if we can bring that tide up, then, you know, we all stand to gain, but also our own holdings in our own portfolios.
As long as the ice caps don't melt and raise it too high.
That's
but anyway, that's another issue.
Yeah.
But all of these things, a lot of them, yes, you can't do anything about, right? You have to mitigate for it. And mental health is the one thing that almost crosses all of this, mm-hmm. isn't it? And, oh, and social media, of course.
Yes.
That is a nightmare for mental health and looking after people at work, isn't it?
Oh, I'm just reading a book called The Anxious Generation. Have you read this one?
No.
It's amazing. You should read it. It's fairly new. I'm afraid I'm an idiot, so I can't remember who the author is.
Don't worry.
But it's brilliant, and it's about Gen Z, as I believe they're called, and essentially the generation that came of age, that went through puberty, that grew up with iPhones that were new and unregulated, well, no, it's still unregulated, are. but with parents who had no idea what their children were looking at or what they were able to access. And it sort of coincided with increasingly overprotective parenting when it came to physical risks. So, you know, you don't let your child on the street on its own.
No.
In case, you know, a mass murderer comes and gets them, or until they get stabbed or, like, I don't know, kidnapped.
Yeah.
And yet they're at home and you're letting them look at the entirety of the internet and everything that's on it without any, you know, completely
It scares me to death, actually.
So, your question as it pertains to mental health, is a big one. I don't have a solution as an investor from my perspective, apart from, but as a parent, it's pretty terrifying.
So we touched on capitalism a little earlier, mm-hmm. and capitalism 2.0, which I think is what we need to move to, is where the work that you're doing determines the share price.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be great, wouldn't it?
So it's not about return. It's about how you look after your people and how you interact with the economy and how you interact with your local environment.
Well, I mean,
isn't, you know,
there are sort of green shoots of hope.
Yes, there are.
In places. I mean, you remember when, I can't remember when it was now. Probably 2021. Boohoo was in the press for allegations of modern slavery being found in fact, I think it was its UK supply chain, and the share price fell by 45% very quickly, and then of course sadly recovered again. But it does show that, you know, sometimes these social risks can be financially material to a business.
Yeah, but yes, they can, and your access to capital is cut off for a short time. But actually, you'd then argue that it's the traders in the City of London who are just taking advantage of the fact that there's bad news, so they short or do whatever they need to do.
Sort of cutting off the capital is an interesting one, because while in theory it works, I don't think in practice.
But could
really
it?
It works. But if you look at tobacco companies, like, you know, we don't invest in tobacco companies. As in, we don't invest in companies that generate 5% or more of their revenue from tobacco.
Okay.
So that takes out all manufacturers of tobacco. And tobacco companies are sort of really, by most people, seen as the bad guys now. You know,
Like oil.
Like oil. Oil, not quite.
I bet you're in
oil,
aren't you?
No, we're not.
Are we not?
No oil and gas companies in any of our portfolios across any client type. We've taken that as a house position. Which we often get challenged on. but tobacco, and yet, despite restrictions on tobacco companies being quite mainstream now across the investment industry, they're not cut off from capital, are they? Like, someone's still investing in these companies.
Yeah.
So I think the what we need to do, and I wish, you know, I really trying to work out how to think more creatively about this, because there needs to be a little bit more of a groundswell of support on these things, because ultimately, if a company can't sell their products because they are blacklisted in the public eye, then that is really going to hurt their business models and the share price.
But do people really associate, you know, a product on Tesco's shelf with a company that has been blacklisted for modern slavery?
Well, I'll give you an example. So Shein, a company that, or Shine, Shein.
The domestic cleaners.
But it should be a domestic cleaning company. No, it's clothes, it's apparel. So it's basically really cheap clothes that are manufactured very, very cheaply.
I should know this,
across.
Shouldn't I, really?
Well, it's good that you don't.
Yes, it is.
These clothes.
No, I haven't bought any clothes for a long time, trust me.
But they were not allowed to list on the New York Stock Exchange because of concerns around their labour standards. So who was manufacturing their garments, where they were being manufactured, and the conditions within which these people
Very
were
good.
Working.
Very good.
Now, Shein is now trying to list on the London Stock Exchange, and it looks as though they may. I think the negotiations are still on the way. Our chief executive came out in the press and said he thinks it shouldn't be allowed. You know, we shouldn't be a dumping ground for businesses with questionable labor standards. And I sort of didn't hear all that much more about it beyond the financial press for a few months. Now, my lovely nanny is away on holiday at the moment. And so we've brought in this amazing 19-year-old from Glasgow, who's a student in Glasgow, to help us out for a week, right? And I was talking to her about my job last night. And she said, oh, I signed a petition yesterday. And she sent me the link. And the link was a petition that says, say no to Shein. And it was exactly the whole thing. It was saying
wow.
The London Stock Exchange should not allow Shein to list on the platform. So I feel like, so that group of people, this 19-year-old who is an obvious target for a company like Shein,
yeah.
as in like, you know.
Is saying no.
Ideal See, customer, I, and now not buying them
yeah,
from
old,
them.
Old Greta.
And that is powerful.
Old Greta's got quite a lot to be thankful for, I suppose, is that or even to answer for, because she's transformed the way people look at it. She's sort of gone off the radar a little bit at the moment, but it's mobilizing that generation, and it's those sorts of things that will make a difference.
Yeah.
But going back to my Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King example, it took 50 or 60 years, so it's two generations before we get to the point where actually we're quite comfortable with civil rights and gay rights. And
maybe, but that was before the internet.
That's true. That's very interesting, actually. Yes, maybe. But I still think attitudinally it takes at least a generation.
Yeah. So yeah, you've got to get your parents need to die off, don't they?
With the old thoughts
and the old generation.
Yeah, broadly they do. Yeah. But that's why I mentioned about white middle class bully boys, men, old, in boardrooms. They need to leave.
Yeah.
And the new generation needs to come through. Changing tack slightly, you know the data that you produce. Do you think young people could use that to determine which companies they want to work for?
Oh, yes. And not just young people.
No, I shouldn't be.
So I
shouldn't restrict it to the young,
well,
should I?
Well, I had somebody who I was speaking to the other day who was leaving the... So he was in charge of the mental health at one of the UK banks. And he said, I'm leaving and I am using your benchmark to help me choose which employer I would like to go to next.
That is so good.
And he said, what he was really interesting, what he said, I'm flicking through, sorry, I know this is
That's
a bit all right. unprofessional.
No, don't worry.
But he said, so the benchmark is split into four areas, four sort of themes, if you like, which are management, commitment and policy. So this looks at commitment from the highest level.
Yeah, it's not just walking the talk, it's living it.
Well, this is the talk bit. So this is policy commitments.
Okay.
So this is the policy.
But the execution of that is...
policy? Yeah. Is the scope clear? Do we know who it applies to, where it applies? And then the principles of good work. So, you know, anti-bullying, diversity, equity, inclusion, board, employee information and consultation. You know, flexible working, fair pay. So the policy level, so management, commitment and policy, that's the first section. Then you have governance and management. So that's how that policy is translated into the day-to-day working life of the business.
Yep.
Who's responsible? Do you train your people? Do you run initiatives? Do you set objectives, targets, etc.? Third area is leadership and innovation. So that's about collaborating with academia or other players in the industry. And then the fourth and final part is performance reporting and impact. So where you set objectives and targets, do you then report on progress against them? Where you run initiatives, do you report on the uptake of those initiatives? Where you train your line managers, do you report on the proportion of line managers that have been trained?
Do you
Now, this guy, very quickly,
so no, go on.
Choosing, he wanted to find a business that scored very well on management commitment, but not so well on the other parts. So he wanted to find a business where the management were already invested in this. So he didn't want to have that initial battle. He didn't want to join a company where management were not interested. He wanted a business where he knew he'd have money to spend and a space to think about how to creatively implement commitment at the top throughout the business.
But isn't it the last one, which if I remember what you said, which is not that long ago, is about the reporting and the data that you report.
Yes.
Right. So, for example, if somebody says, yeah, we really look after our people, we run these seminars and these workshops and these away days and so on, and we've had, you know, this year we've done 25, next year our plan is for 50. Well, that's a sort of so what, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because they can all run them. And I know from personal experience, when you're not feeling good about yourself, the worst thing you can possibly do is go away for a long weekend with your colleagues, and all you want to do is just disappear. Mm-hmm. So it's not the actual undertaking of these activities. It's about what impact does it have? How does it change the behaviour in your organisation? So do you ever get a stat that says incidences of bullying? I bet you don't, do you?
Well, we wouldn't think is we wouldn't be looking for it. We wouldn't be looking for that in particular. However, you know, we could award points to a company where they've said, you know, we, this is sort of theoretical here, but we appreciate that bullying in the workplace can cause mental ill health. We track incidents of bullying, or, you know, we ask employees to disclose bullying anonymously. In X year, the incident rate was X. Our aim or objective or target is to reduce that to X.
And then report it next year.
And then that would bring a company
I agree.
A lot of points. Yeah.
But how do any do that?
And I'm, off the top of my head, I don't think so.
No.
But they do something, you know, a lot of them do something similar where they'll say, you know, we run employees pulse surveys, and in that survey there's a question about how well supported do you feel by your business, or have you suffered from mental ill health in the last 12 months, or, you know, do you believe that the support provided by your employer is sufficient, and then they will disclose that and then set targets on.
But in a way, that's sort of judgmental, isn't it? I mean, wouldn't it be good, you know, to go to the HR team and say, how many complaints have you had from your staff this month, or, you know, over the last year or whatever?
Yeah.
Would they disclose it?
But that's the tricky thing. And because there are risks with disclosing something like that. Once you've made a complaint formal, then companies have to take very strong action, and often it results in somebody being kicked out. So
But
maybe that's a good thing, but
I can say if they're behaving badly, yes, it is a good thing, because it shows to everybody else that you can't do it.
Sorry, there's a risk to the person disclosing it as well, because it may end up not working.
Could be managed, though.
Yes, it could be managed. But also, it's a little bit like, you know, disclosing mental ill health, because you might think, okay, we want this company to have 100% happy employees. In which case, if they are disclosing that they've had a 20% mental health incidence rate this year, then that's a bad thing and they need to bring it down. Actually, I think, you know, we're starting from the knowledge and the understanding that between 1 in 4 and 1 in 10 of us at any point have a mental health condition, in which case you should be, you know, you should have between 10 and 20% uptake of your employee assistance program. You need to be increasing that number, not reducing it.
Yeah, I see. So you express it as a positive rather than as a negative.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So we're beginning to run out of time, and I do want to just talk upon two things. Mm-hmm. Firstly, the toolbox, which you presented at your CCLA seminar. And I just thought that was fantastic, particularly the last bit that you said about it. So do you want to just explain very quickly how it works?
Yes. Okay. So my role at CCLA is in stewardship. Now, stewardship is part of the sustainability team, and the purpose of stewardship is to as I said right at the beginning, speak to the companies that we're investing in and try to get them to improve their business practices. Now, there are various different tools available to people in stewardship.
Great analogy.
Thank you. It was a bit gimmicky, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Is it yours?
Yes, yes.
Is it?
Yeah, it was mine.
Well done.
Where the various tools available to us, which allow you to incentivize businesses to change. And because really, you know, you'll know this, there is absolutely no way in hell you can persuade somebody to do something that they don't want to do.
No.
You have to make them want to do it themselves. And so the tools are there, and if you use them in a certain way, it can be a very powerful motivator for companies to want to improve. So you've got anything when it comes to investing and engagement, you've got anything from voting at company annual general meetings to direct engagement, that is phone calls, emails, you know, meetings with the companies that you're investing in, to collaborating with other shareholders. So you might group together as part of a coalition and, you know, ask a company to do something as a collective voice.
But they all have an association with a tool.
They all have association with a tool, don't they?
And that's the bit that I thought, well, it just made it memorable. It brought it to life.
Well, you caught me as I was packing up my toolbox and putting the ladder away, I think. I'd packed the ladder in the car. The ladder, of course, representing policy engagement, which is, you know, very, very important when it comes to some of these things.
But I thought the one that I liked was the screwdriver and the power drill.
Yes.
Right. So the screwdriver, you can apply pressure.
Yes.
Right. But it's going to be hard work to apply the pressure.
Yes. Well, if you apply too much pressure. So the screwdriver represented in engagement, that is communicating directly with companies. If you apply too much pressure, you're going to break that relationship.
It slips.
And it won't work.
Yeah. But then there's the power drill.
The power drill.
Which does the same job, but 3 to 4, 5, 6, 10 times
better. Well, you were really listening. This is amazing.
I was.
And the power drill was collaborative engagement.
Yeah.
So ramping up the speed, the visibility, the positive impact of an engagement by collaborating.
And that's what you do, isn't it? That's
yes.
why you've got your $7 trillion exactly. under investment being represented in what you do.
Yeah.
The best bit of it, though, was right at the end you said that you can try all of these tools, and if they don't work, you take your toolbox away. You shut it up and walk away. And I thought, yeah, but basically what you're then saying is, we're not going to invest in you.
Yeah.
That's it. You're not good enough for us in terms of investment. And you've always got that choice, haven't you?
I've got that choice. But, you know, we really try not to get to that place because it's giving up. And once you've sold a company, then you've lost your opportunity to change it.
True, but you get stubborn people, don't you? And they're just not interested. And you have to apply your pressures elsewhere where you're going to get a result. But yeah, I take your point.
There's no point in engaging for the sake of it. If you can't change, if a company can't or won't change, then there comes a time when you have to divest.
Yeah. Right, last few minutes then. And I generally try to like to ask these my guests these things, but have you or anybody in your family or your friends or anything had a mental health issue at all?
Plenty of people I know, yeah. Younger generations tend to talk about it more.
Which is fantastic.
I'm a millennial, and it's still hard, I think, for millennials to talk about this. It really is. I think it's the younger ones in our business that are much more open about it, which is great. A very close family member of mine works for and has worked for 15 years, one of the biggest US investment banks.
It's financial services again, I'm sorry.
Financial services. Mm. And
US particularly can be very bad.
Yes.
Goldman's
yes.
being one of them.
That kind of idea. And has really struggled with their mental health up and down over the last probably 6 years. And it's so obvious to me how they could make that life, that working life better. It's so obvious as an outsider how that investment bank could structure their work. Like they're just there's so many obvious things. Because I feel like we talked about the principles of good work, financial, well, you know, fair pay being one.
Yeah.
I feel like these banks, I don't want to generalize because they're all different, but they tend to overpay their staff and then ignore all everything else. So they say, we're paying you so much,
we're going to grind
to
you
hell
into
with
the
everything
ground.
Else. We yeah. don't care about anti-bullying, non-harassment. We don't care about proper approach to diversity, equity, and inclusion. We're not going to keep you informed and consulted as changes are made in the business and as we, you know, tinker with your life. we're not going to give you any flexible working out of the question. And you know, pay a little less, do a little bit better with these other things, yeah. and then people will stay longer and they'll be happier and they'll yeah. be more productive.
Yeah.
And they'll be loyal.
Does this person that you know, what do they do to help their mental well-being?
Not very much.
Yeah, you see, that's...
And
you,
terrified
so much
to
you can
speak
do.
To their boss about it in case
I get that. I get that.
Them
yeah.
being promoted.
I get that, but there's so much you can do around that.
And there's a lot of stigma, even now, attached to using an employee assistance program.
Yeah.
You say, oh, no, that's not for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was the same with therapy, yeah. you know, refusing because I just didn't... I thought I could do it all on my own.
Yeah.
But how do you support this person if you get the chance to do that?
Oh, listen. No, I think really, I just keep trying to get them to speak to their employer.
So they do.
But I think they're more likely to leave than speak to their employer.
Yeah, you see, you've always got that choice, haven't you? You can say, this is not for me, I'm going to go somewhere else.
And I hope the employer learns that hard lesson.
Yeah, well, they don't because they pay a lot and therefore they attract a lot. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in. Honestly, I've got pages of notes here we've not even touched on yet. But it's been great chatting with you and thank you for being so open about everything. And I wish you very, very well and good luck in the future.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Cheers. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning in to Just Not Good Enough with me, Chas Howes. As a reminder, you can catch up with all recent shows on fubarradio.com.